Probably you should, though, you know. That's how I kind of view it, like.
It's a seven.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Colleagues got a full agenda today, and we'll get started by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2004. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2004 increases the amount of money collected from residential electric customers for low-income electric bill assistance dependent on Oregon Housing and Community Service Department findings. Repeals the sunset on the collection of additional monies for low-income electric assistance. There is a dash two amendment associated with this. The dash two amendment replaces the measure, increases the amount of money collected from residential electric customers for low-income electric bill assistance if requested by Oregon Housing and Community Service Department. Limits the time increased monies may be collected to 24 months, requires the director of OHCS to appoint advisory committee on low-income electric bill payment funding, provides advisory committee composition, rules, and goals, requires advisory committee to report to the Legislative Assembly by December 1st, 2013 on duties and functions relating to low-income electric bill payment assistance currently held by OHCS and to make reservations to which agency or entity those duties and functions should be transferred, designates topics advisory committee must consider in making recommendation, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
And call up the dynamic duo of Representative McLean and Speaker Kotek, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike McLean. I am the state representative for House District 55. I'll just go first.
He's the good-looking.
Well, I'm sitting up here with Speaker Kotek in support. We both came to sponsor House Bill 2004, and I learned about this program in 2011, and when Speaker Kotek, before she was Speaker, and she was a mere member of Ways and Means like I was, and she showed me this bill that she wanted to run that had the effect of taking what was otherwise cost passed on to ratepayers in our regulated utilities and the electric companies, and said, hey, you know, let's, if we're going to bear these costs anyway, perhaps there's a way in which for the same amount and perhaps even less we can take this the same that ratepayers would be paying and help people who aren't able to pay their electric bills and give them a subsidy for a period of time until they're able to take that back over. And it's and it certainly during times in which it's cold can keep the heat on. And as she explained it to me, because Representative Kotek and I had worked on some budget matters together, I realized that what favor she was doing for me, because my district 55 in 2011 was still in the throes of the Great Recession. And in fact, if you look at the demographic who benefits from a program, it really disproportionately benefited my district as opposed to hers. And because it's cold in District 55, and we have the highest unemployment in the state, certainly in Crook County, and I believe district-wide, and we had a lot of struggling people. And so as I looked at the numbers, I immediately wanted to be a good conservative Republican and make sure not a dime more. And then I looked at the numbers and realized it was very fiscally responsible, and this and we had this because of the cutoff cost and restarting that those costs are normalized and passed to the ratepayers. This program doesn't raise the cost on anybody. And so I fully supported it and am very glad I did. And since that time, I've come to realize what a program like this was very beneficial. I'd like to, first of all, again, thank her for including me and showing me that this really was a great program. And her staff, especially Tim Inman, for the work across party lines and to really bring a benefit to rural Oregon. It has been wonderful to work with them. Finally, I know that there's been some amendments to the Dash 2 I support and appreciate your consideration of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative
Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the Oregon House. It's a pleasure to be here with Representative McClain. As Mike has mentioned, we did work together on Senate Bill 863 in 2011, and I'm really glad we're doing this together again. I think when we passed the bill in 2011, we assumed we wouldn't have to be back. The current legislation that we pass expires at January of next year, but we still have a lot of Oregonians who are having trouble paying their bills, no doubt about it. I saw the movie that was on HBO recently that was filmed here in Oregon called American Winter, and one of the biggest issues that families are still dealing with because they're underemployed or they're dealing with medical crises is paying their energy bills, paying their electric bills, getting shut-off notices. And what the utilities told us 2 years ago was it makes more sense to help people keep their lights on than shut them off and have to get them back on. And so this is a pot of money that can help people with their assistance that we need, because the feds are still cutting their numbers as well in terms of the energy assistance coming into the state. And whether it's Central Oregon or North Portland, we have folks who are still needing some help to pay their energy, their electric bills. The amendment that you'll have, I think it's a dash two. There might be a dash three only because there's a little tweak, but the original bill has $8 million. The existing program was $5 million. The amendment takes it back down to the $5 million over a 12-month period. The amendment's going to take out the economic triggers that are in the original bill because they were fine in the original program, but we want the amendment will say, let's study this some more. We know that this program works. The utilities are going to be supportive of the amendments. I want to really thank PGE and PacifiCorp for continuing to stay at the table on this. And the amendment also creates a committee to come back to the legislature and say, what should the triggers possibly look like? Who should have the administration of this program? Currently, it resides with Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. They're currently looking at their whole line of business. This might not be the proper place a year from now, so that they will report back to us in February. So so it's renewing the program, but also saying, what else do we need to figure out before we go much further with it? But the bottom line is the concrete way to help people with their energy needs right now, and we don't want this program to go away unnecessarily.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Either one. Are there other people coming up to testify on this as well? Or
we do have another panel representative.
That's okay. I'll just ask an easy question then.
Is this, how many people know something more?
Is this a,
what are you saying, Representative?
Mr. Speaker, is this this pot of money that we're talking about, I really don't understand what the pot of money is, and if there's somebody better suited to explain that, that would be fine. Is this the same as public purpose funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, it is not. Thank you for that question. This is an additional assessment on rate payers to the individual consumer that then is put into a pot of money that can be used to help with shutoff notices. So it's assessed on the all the folks in the pool of rate of who are paying their bills, and then there's a set aside for to help them. And it's been, you know, the original bill allowed the PUC to collect this through PG and PacifiCorp that then could be used for their customers.
So they already do the public purpose fund, and then this is additional on top of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, it's on top of other existing energy assistance programs out there that's either through the public purpose charge or LIHEAP, which is a federal program. There are various energy programs out there. This is specific to the customers for the utilities that are regulated by the PUC, in this case, PG and PacifiCorp.
Follow up?
Yes, I would, and I guess the question I had, we had triggers, and then and I thought, well, those are great because it made a lot of sense to me, and then the triggers are going away. It seems that, and trust me, I support helping those that are in need, especially in the cold. I mean, and so I even feel almost like I shouldn't even be asking these questions, but I will. Is this essentially a tax, if you will, on all ratepayers, and would it be hitting them at a time when they're possibly struggling as well, if it is during a time of a down economy? You know, and this.
Well, I can assure you, Representative Chair Bailey and Representative Reardon, it's not a tax. I want to make sure I go publicly on record. I'm not voting for a tax. But what it is when you're in the unique situation of a regulated utility, The cost of that are passed on to the ratepayers, and you know, the PUC approves their certain rates based on projected costs and et cetera. And when you have shutoffs coming on and people are unable to pay their bills, those costs, because of the nature of the utility, are spread out amongst all ratepayers.
Right.
And so in that regard, it's a cost of the system that is borne already. And the question is whether this pool of money we created to alleviate those shutoffs, whether that pool becomes bigger than what those shutoffs actually would have been. And they've got enough data that they run that they can actually hit that sweet spot where they say this actually is not going to increase the costs anyway, and it ends up not having to incur the cost of the shutoffs. And what you do is then decrease the costs for that individual homeowner who needs that relief for a period of time, and then you and you have some who aren't able to incur the costs, and some who are able to come back up and be full payers. But it's not a tax in that the regulated utility aspect. Has the ratepayers bearing it in any event?
I think I follow that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, okay. It's a cost avoidance piece, right? The costs are already in the system, and as Representative McLean said,
yeah.
It helps avoid the additional costs that come with shutoffs. I don't know if that helps.
Okay.
So. Sorry.
Thank you.
I think she said in two sentences what I did in 4 minutes, and that's why she's speaker.
Yeah. Well, I think Representative Dimbro whispered it in one phrase, which was preventative care.
Rate mitigation.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Representative McLean, in your comments, you mentioned that you supported the original bill back in 2011 because your constituents were, to a large degree, still in the throes of the Great Recession. Has that condition changed over the last 2 years appreciably?
Thank you, Chair Bailey and Representative Johnson. There is not relief from the Great Recession in District 55 yet. There has been stabilization of the unemployment rate. It's still the highest in the state, like Cook County, my county, for an example. And I think folks think we're bumping along, but statistically, rural Oregon is not out. And District 55 is the classic rural district.
Thank you.
Representative Whitsitt.
What will the cost be to the utilities to administer this new part of this? You're talking about the old, you know, essentially the previous part. Is there a new administration fee for figuring out new people coming on versus those going off and trying to keep it all level, like you were saying? I'm just trying to figure out, is there going to be some cost somewhere in this since it's a new program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, that would be a good question. I assume the utilities are here. Some question about how this should be administered. That's why you'll see in the amendment that people want to go sit around a table and say, are we administering it the right way? Currently, the money comes through the state agency out to individual nonprofit providers. There is some conversation about whether it makes more sense to have that more in-house at the utilities. So we didn't know how that would be determined, and that needs more work. So that's why it'll come back in a year. So. But there might be costs, but they'll know. You'd have to ask them.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaker Kotek, Leader McLean, is probably the only member on here who's one of the sponsors of this bill. I have to say the thing that sold me on the bill was the triggers. So I'm not sure if I'm still going to be there without the triggers in this bill. I'll have to see what you come up with, and I guess we'll be waiting to see what they come up with the cost and everything for it, because I understand the situation and everything, but the other thing we don't want is people taking advantage of this as well. So we need to keep people responsible for their own actions, because they might say, oh, they're not going to shut my power off, so I'll just wait a while to pay this and take care of other things. And where usually you have a penalty if you're late on a bill or something like that. So I'll be kind of curious to see where we're at, but just want you to know my concerns as one of the sponsors of this bill and with the sounds of the amendments that are coming.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, good question. I think the macro triggers in the original legislation that from last time and also this time. There was some interest in perhaps finding a different way to when the money kicks in from a economic perspective. We did meet the triggers last time, but that's a good question for the stakeholders. This is at their request, and so to get their take on it would be helpful. So.
Could we preserve this bipartisanship for just a moment? Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you very much to this
thank
panel.
You.
They were both quite red for that.
And, Speaker Kotek, I'll keep you up here briefly. Colleagues, the Speaker has other business and needs to testify on a different bill, so I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2004, open the public hearing on House Bill 2005. Speaker Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, Speaker of the House, here on in support of House Bill 2005. There are some wonderful experts who are going to talk to you about the wonders of mechanical insulation. Last year, I found out all about why we should put insulation around piping and mechanical systems like HVAC and water pipes and all, and how that helps the energy efficiency of buildings. And the more I learned, the more I was like, what are we doing here in Oregon? So what you have in 2005 is a starting point to bring to your attention that mechanical insulation is a good thing and that we should make sure all of our new buildings have it, as well as our existing buildings, particularly public buildings. The bill talks about industrial buildings. That was just how it got drafted. But you're going to hear from experts who will tell us about what kind of value there is in having mechanical insulation. We currently have on the books in our building code standards the best standard in terms of mechanical insulation, but I think there are still some things we could do more of, educating our local inspectors about how to identify that, making sure construction companies and architects are actually including that in new construction. And then you have the whole issue of existing buildings and whether or not they have them. So I think you'll enjoy learning about mechanical insulation. I think it's really important. Whether or not the bill is needed, I think it'll depend on how the conversation goes. It obviously has to be reworked, but I'm really glad you're going to have the conversation today. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Thank you,
we appreciate
Chair.
It.
Mr. Chair, since I'm deeply involved with mechanical insulation, do I have to stay and listen?
temporarily close public hearing on House Bill 2005. Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2004. Call up Brian Fisher, Jeff Bissonnette, and Scott Bolton, please.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here today on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is a statewide association of community action agencies. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2004. I wanted to, first of all, let you know that this is an extremely important funding stream. It's an extremely important service that we provide across the state of Oregon, and this bill would really help impact the areas that are covered by the PGE and Pacific Core territory. We do what's called an energy snapshot every year, and I would be happy to share this with you if you haven't already seen it, but it gives a snapshot of what the needs are around the state in terms of energy. And one thing that we know is that particularly in areas of the state that have what we call a longer heating season, this is a very difficult time right now, and we have a lot of families that are really struggling to meet their basic needs and to be able to stay warm during the winter. A lot of the folks who we serve, we prioritize seniors in a lot of areas. We prioritize veterans. We prioritize folks with disabilities. This is critical to them in order to be able to make sure that they can meet all of their household budget needs. They're choosing between medicine, paying their electric bills, or paying rent. And so by making sure that we can help folks meet their basic needs, it makes sure that then they have the opportunity to be able to lean into solving the problems that they've got so that they can move forward. And those are things like, in some cases, job training, et cetera, or finding sustainable ways to live. One thing that we want to talk about is that when your power gets shut off, oftentimes what that leads to is an eviction. and to homelessness. And so we talked a little bit so far today about the cost, and this is another cost that is outside of that system, but it's very much impacts all of our communities. When somebody's not able to stay in their home, there are impacts on their health, there are impacts on public safety. There is, all of this is integrated, it's all connected. So we are extremely supportive of this concept. We're concerned about the impacts that sequestration are having on some of the federal funding streams that perform these same services, and as testimony earlier described, we are still seeing a lot of families that are really struggling, and this is a very important tool to help make sure that we can help families meet their basic needs. I really appreciate the collaboration on this bill. The utilities have been fantastic to work with. Citizens Utility Board, we're all sitting here together because we've all been in agreement along the pathway to figuring out how to get this bill done. To address your question, Representative Widener, about the triggers, one of the things that we put in these amendments is a hard stop after 2 years, so this sunsets. And we've asked a work group to convene to figure out how do we continually make this program better. And one of the things that we would like this work group to address is, are there some triggers that would make sense moving forward? So we're going to continue to have that conversation. I think there were some problems with the particular triggers that were designed last time. We're not opposed to that concept. We just need to get the right ones, and this is the way that we are working through the process. So those are my comments. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I know my colleagues have some other things to share as well.
Thank you. Mr. Bissonnette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. We are here to speak in support of House Bill 2004. Just to give a little background, energy assistance in Oregon to add to whatever we were getting from the federal government was really instituted in PG and PacifiCorp territory back in 1999 by setting an energy assistance charge separate from the public purpose charge, as Speaker Kotek said, to raise $10 million. That was increased to raise $15 million in 2007, and that's kind of where we were when we started looking at this issue 2 years ago. Then we were in the midst of the Great Recession. A lot of people were having trouble. That $15 million wasn't going far enough, and so we did this 2-year extension for $5 million a year. That's the piece that's coming to an end if 2004 doesn't pass. We certainly understand, we hear a lot from our members and from ratepayers that folks are having a tough time of it. The one difference between the $15 million that is permanent and stays, and this additional $5 million is this additional $5 million is only borne by residential ratepayers, and that was kind of a compromise that we did a couple years ago, and we're willing to continue that compromise while we kind of figure out the whole program going forward. I'll just kind of note on a policy basis, it's, cost to the system is borne by both residential ratepayers and business ratepayers, and so we are either all in this together or we're not, and so eventually we'd like to see that sort of come back around. But again, times are tough and we needed to move this ahead, and so we were willing to bear that cost. I think to get at a question that Representative Whitsitt had, the impact on residential ratepayers for everything, the permanent $15 million and this extra is around 80 to 85 cents a month on the bill. So, that cost is definitely less than having a lot of people be cut off, reconnected, et cetera. It does save cost to the system overall, and that's one reason why we're very supportive of this, beyond just the humanitarian reason of making sure that people can keep their lights on, can keep their heat on, and especially families with children, families with senior citizens, that's particularly important. So we're very proud to support House Bill 2004 and look forward to taking part in the sort of work group, task force, whatever it is, going forward, looking at capturing either savings or administrative changes that can make sure that these programs can continue on into the future and continue to serve Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bolt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Scott Bolt on behalf of Pacific Corp. We serve all over the state as Pacific Power, including Speaker Kotek's district and Representative McLean's district. So we really appreciate their leadership and they're looking out for their constituents. I don't have a whole lot to add that hasn't already been covered by my colleagues, but again, this is really, the way we see it, is simply a more streamlined extension of Senate Bill 863, which passed in 2011. We do believe this bill will help help our most vulnerable customers, as well as protecting the rest of our ratepayers, because there, as Representative McLean, I think, ably described, there is a sweet spot there where if you provide enough assistance to help people through a tough time, we are avoiding the costs and kind of downward spiral for customers who really get behind and we have to shut off their service, and that becomes a cost that's ultimately borne by all of our customers. So being able to provide a little bit to provide a bridge for when people need the help is actually good business for us, and it's a concept we support. And the extension that we're talking about here, the additional $5 million, in 2011 we thought that we would be out of the worst of the recession. We thought that, you know, we have another 2 years, a little supplemental assistance, and that's going to get us through. And certainly for Pacific Power, when you look at the communities we serve, and a lot of those are representative here in this committee today, you know your districts as well as we do. There's still some folks who are still hurting and struggling. So another 2 years seems reasonable, isn't an enormous burden within our rates, and we think makes good public policy. And probably the other thing I would want to make sure we touch on is that historically most of the energy assistance dollars that have come into Oregon have been through the federal LIHEAP program, and that's a program that has seen reduced investment from the federal government and is certainly at some degree of risk under the federal sequester. So this is a case of Oregonians doing a little bit more to help Oregonians, and is something we support. I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt.
We have neighbors who are single-family farm owners whose electric bills exceed $100,000 a year for their family. What would they be contributing towards? Are they contributing towards this then, or is it only residential for the whole program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, if they're farmers, then they're probably on an irrigation customer schedule. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I don't believe that is picked up either as a business or as an irrigation customer. I don't believe that they're contributing to the supplemental fund. It really is within the residential ratepayer tariffs that we have.
I'm seeing head nods behind you.
Yeah.
And could I follow
Please,
up?
Yeah.
How long does the average household stay on your program once they get on? And what is the level? It says poverty level, but is that federal poverty level? Is it 120% of poverty level? What?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, I would be happy to come and give you a full explanation of the eligibility. There are folks who are more knowledgeable on those details than I am as their representative. But I do know that the community action agencies, what they do is they determine who is eligible, and it is based on income scales and percentage of federal poverty level. And my understanding is that a family is only eligible for one assistance payment per year, and I will happily confer all that and share it both with you and with the rest of the committee as well. But that is part of the role that the community action agencies play, is to determine eligibility and to distribute that to families that are in need.
Thank you. Further questions?
Sure.
Representative Banks.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you answered this, Scott, but you said it was a question of finding the sweet spot of how much is the right amount. Are we close to it here, or do you think we're above it, or are we below it? Where are we?
Chair Bailey, Representative Vance, I think the $5 million extension seemed to be where it met most people's needs. One of the interesting dynamics that we've seen over the last few years is that even when we have been able to increase assistance, we're still seeing more bad debt. I mean, we're having more write-offs because of customers' inability to pay. But we think that that's starting to tail off as the economy's starting to slowly recover, especially in the more rural parts of the state. And so as we look ahead over the next 2 years, and especially as we look at the issues around governance and how to more efficiently get these dollars deployed, I think it's probably sufficient for now. But it will entail a larger conversation about how to best administer low-income assistance programs going forward, even beyond the $5 million implicated in this bill.
Thank you. So I guess my question, I heard you say the need might be greater, but I was also interested in the other side of the equation, which is the ratepayer and the suggestion to the ratepayer that this is the least expensive means of managing this unfortunate situation. So is your answer applicable to both of those sides of the equation?
Yes, Representative. This is when we say sweet spot, it really is how can we provide the most help while also being very sensitive to the rest of our customers who are essentially paying to support this program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Whitener.
Just real quick, and you can get this to me offline, but I'd be kind of curious just to see what the ratepayer cost would be if we didn't have this program and you were shutting the power off, turning the power back on. Because when you have your power shut off on you, you learn real quick, I don't want this to happen again, and I find a way to get my bill in. That's why I'm glad we kind of have triggers where we're going to do it once, because there's a learning lesson that people have to go through here, but I understand people hurting. I'd just like to know where we would be if we didn't have the program rate-wise. Would it be $2 more? And this is a dollar, so we're saving the ratepayer dollar. So we have those savings. Yeah. And can justify them. So if you could get that to us offline, I imagine probably most of the committee members would want that because it's something we need to share with our districts too.
Yes, we do a lot of that kind of analysis, so I'd be happy to share that with you and the committee.
Great. Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, close the public hearing. House Bill 2004. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2004. Colleagues, we're not going to move the bill today, but I would like to move the amendment into the bill so that the bill is appropriately written and give you guys a chance to digest over the weekend, have some conversations, and get the FSRIS ready. So, with that.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2004.
Vice Chair Johnson moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2004. Is there any discussion? And clerk will call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Representative Whitson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. Dash twos are in. I'm going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2004 and close the work session on House Bill 2004. We're going to go through a little bit more business here first before we come back to 2005. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3451. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members
of
the committee.
Explain to us where we are on this bill. Colleagues, you'll remember that this is the bill we heard about Oregon State University and their research program. Just a quick update.
Sure. Chair Bailey, we have a dash one amendment for that, clarifying language around research areas. We have a no impact, no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact statement attached, and this does have a subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Colleagues, what's your pleasure?
Send it to Ways and Means.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt dash one amendments dated March 22nd, 2013. To the House Bill 3451.
Vice Chair Johnson moves the dash one amendments dated March 22nd, 2013 to House Bill 3451. Is there discussion? Is there objection on this motion? Motion carries.
Vice Chair, Johnson. I move House Bill 3451 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Johnson moves House Bill 3451 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Vance.
Aye.
Representative Dembrough.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Baker Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
Aye.
Representative Whitchett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Bailey.
Aye. Motion passes. It's on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 3451. Once again, we're going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2801, caught in the backlog, so we will not be doing that one today. Open a work session on House Bill 2893. Colleagues, the paperwork for this bill is not ready for the FIS-RIS, but we do have an amendment that's ready, and I'd like to call up a few folks to explain what's happening with the amendment on House Bill 2893. Representative Reardon, do you want to preface this in any way?
Just a brief introduction. We did have a very cooperative work group that worked through any issues had to do with a desire to extend a solar project, and it had to balance the needs of the utilities with the and avoid shifts of rates onto ratepayers in an inappropriate manner, and also help protect the solar installation industry, and so that it could continue to grow. The main work will be around a study so that we can better understand what this industry is about and how we can proceed in the future. So.
And Representative, I want to thank you very much for taking on this task and this work group and having many meetings on it and coming out with a good consensus product.
So. Very much my pleasure.
Thank you. I'd like to call up Jeff Bissonnette again, Brian Pascoe, and Marion Haynes to come talk about this amendment.
Thanks.
And we'll get Jeff when he comes back.
We are missing Jeff.
Yeah. Ms. Haynes, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Marion Haynes. I represent PGE. We had this all scripted, and Jeff was supposed
Jeff
to go
isn't here.
First. But I guess Jeff is going to be the one who's going to walk through the Dash 2 amendments and what all of the pieces that have done. But I'm here to sort of talk about from the utility perspective.
Here he is.
Okay. I will hold off on my comments.
Mr. Bissonnette, I apologize. I didn't see you leave the room. Okay. However, you should just expect that you have a name planted on one of these chairs in any given hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board. I apologize for being out of the room. There's another hearing going on in Senate Business Committee. I was just quickly going to go through the bill, and it's actually a pretty simple bill, and then my colleagues are going to sort of drill down on a couple of specific issues, and then, of course, happy to answer questions. The bill really does two things. The bill first establishes sort of a study process at the PUC in conjunction with the Department of Energy to look at what we call the solar resource value. What is the value of solar to the system? Because what we have in the current feed-in tariff pilot is basically a payment for production of solar electricity. And what we really want to figure out is, as we go forward and want to, and if it makes sense to continue to pay for production, what is that value to the system and pay that value? And the question is that value the same as, higher, lower than what we pay for kind of traditional resources? And so basically it is section 4 of the bill that really outlines and provides direction to the Public Utility Commission to undertake that study. Secondly, the bill extends in a very small way the current existing feed-in tariff pilot that was started with legislation that was passed in back in 2009. And that pilot runs its course by the end of March of 2015. And what this bill does is extends that pilot until March of 2016 for another 2.5 megawatts on top of the existing 25 megawatts, really targeted on small commercial type systems, because during the course of the conversation amongst the utilities, amongst ratepayers, amongst the solar industry, we thought that that was an area where we really didn't think we were learning much from the pilot, and we could learn a little bit more with a slight extension. And so that piece is part of this agreement. Outside of this bill, but very much connected to it, is an agreement between Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, the Citizens Utility Board, and also Renewable Northwest Project to go to the PUC to request an investigation docket on the issues of cross-subsidization and consumer subsidies for net metering and the existing net metering program. That's an issue that's very important to the utilities to figure out, over the course of the discussion around this bill, we decided that asking the PUC within existing authority to really take on this docket would be the best way to get at that. And so it's not something we needed to legislate, but it is something we wanted to put on the record that it is has been a key part of the discussion around this bill, and just to let you know that that we'll be doing that in a joint way. So with that, I do want to, just on behalf of CUB, and I'm sure we'll be joined for the leadership of Representative Reardon. The chair put him in charge of that, and I'm not sure he knew quite what the deep end he was getting into, but he came up to speed really quickly, and then was well staffed by the committee administrator. And so this was a very good and very productive work group, and we really appreciate all of the work around this, and we're happy to support the bill with the amendments before you, and I'm happy to answer questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you, Mr. Bissonnette. Now, Ms. Haynes.
Once again, Marion Haynes with Portland General Electric. I again want to echo the thanks for Representative Reardon and his leadership, and also for Adam and all the work that he did. He's a very expert at keeping meetings running on time and on schedule, so that's always much appreciated.
Except when I'm chairing. I'm way over.
When we started this discussion, I think that the work group started pretty far apart. The utilities had, I think, some reluctance on doing any kind of significant extension of the feed-in tariff. There were a lot of folks that would have liked to seen this bill go farther than it has. But as Jeff here has said, I think through the discussions that were very collaborative and constructive, we really got to air a lot of the issues on both sides, whether it's utilities and some of the cost shift that we've now found another way to begin to address through a different process, or the levels of subsidy and agreeing that we need to get a better handle on solar resource value and really what solar looks like and how it interacts in the utility system. Being able to do that kind of investigation, recognizing that there is a need, particularly in the commercial, small to mid-sized commercial feed-in, to understand what the costs are really for those size of installations, who's going to do those, and what kinds of things we need to help increase those. Those are really, becoming more cost effective. There's still some subsidy required, but it's important that we learn as much as we can from those systems, and that had been a pretty small part of the existing pilot. So we are happy to be here with this consensus work group product. Again, I would really commend everybody in the room for being very open to listening to the issues from the other side and trying to address those, recognizing that everybody didn't get exactly what they want out of this bill, but I do think it's a good product, and it was a good process to get there. Thanks.
Mr. Pascoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brian Pascoe. I'm the director of the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club, and I will be brief, and I don't want to echo too much of what has been said, except there are a few things that are worth repeating, which is our thanks to Representative Reardon and Adam. You all really made this work, and so thank you very much for that. Taking pictures of the three of us. I guess that's, that's the next point I will make, though. I think that the benefits of this work group go well beyond the amendment that you see. I think that Miriam was very right that we opened up quite a dialogue, and I think for the first time we've actually had some real strong conversations among a variety of stakeholders about what renewable energy means in Oregon, where we need to go, what some of the challenges were. You know, this amendment, as you have it before you, is very, very different from the original bill that was put forward. And from that perspective, you know, it's certainly not, I think, what we were hoping for in the session. It's certainly not what we think is needed over the long term, but it represents a compromise, and I think it represents a good step forward for how to move forward in the future. You know, as we went into these work group meetings, which were weeks of work group meetings, but also a lot of hours and time spent outside between those work group meetings between stakeholders, you know, we realized that there really was a need for much greater information gathering in order to make a long-term solution. And so the conversation very quickly became, you know, stepped away from the original proposal and looked at how do we get that information, which became the study piece of this bill, and then also how do we keep the current momentum of the solar industry going until we are able to make some broader long-term solutions, which ended up being the extension of the pilot project. So, you know, we are very hopeful that this is going to create the information we need to come back in 2015 with a much longer-term, broader perspective of how to move solar energy work and solar energy incentives forward in Oregon. We have a long way to go, but this is a good step, and I would encourage you all to support the bill.
Thank you all. And while I leaned over and encouraged Vice Chair Johnson to take another photo, I will say that it is my hope that this isn't a panel that's a rarity, and I would commend the three of you and all of the other people who are involved in the work group on really being able to approach it pragmatically. I know each of you represents constituencies that perhaps a section of which feel uncomfortable, even with this bill, and certainly with some of the proposals that were put on the table. And there are those that would like to do a lot more, those that would like to do something different or less. And the fact that the members of the work group and you three as representatives of that work group were able to engage in a very pragmatic discussion that advances the ball, I think speaks volumes to your ability to actually have the conversations that we need as a state to grow our economy and our energy supply through clean energy. And so thank you. I appreciate your ability to put those things aside and to come together on a bill. I would also note for the record, on Section 4, Subsection 3, there's a report back on July 1st, 2014, from the Public Utility Commission. I'd like to say on the record that it, and we discussed this in the work group, we did not put it in the bill because it was a bit awkward to write into the statutory language, but it is my hope and my understanding from the Public Utility Commission that it is their intention that they will come give an update and initial preliminary recommendations to the 2014 legislative session. We had initially asked that they prepare a report prior to that session so we could see it. That proved to be too aggressive of a timeline to be able to get something that was usable back from them. But while giving them enough time to actually do a cogent report, I think it's very important that we in 2014 have an update on that, so I'll get that on the record. With that, open it up for questions. Representative Whitson.
Will there be a cost to ratepayers or taxpayers if this legislation passes?
May have different perspectives.
And what might that be?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitson. Yes, there will be a cost impact to ratepayers. Due to the modest extension to the feed-in tariff program, I can't speak to exactly what that cost impact will be. One of the pieces of this targeting this portion of the feed-in tariff is that the rates are set, what we will pay to customers are set in part by an RFP process that's really driven to, that really is intended to see how far you can drive down the rates for these types of installations. So currently it's been in the low 20s for these size installations, but without knowing the results of that RFP process, it's hard to tell at this point exactly what that rate impact would be. For context, I would tell you that the rate impact of the full 25 megawatt existing pilot program is about a half of 1% for our system, just under that, about. So this is a 2.5 megawatt extension, much smaller than the original pilot program. And again, the impacts will be lower because much of the current pilot program is residential systems, which are more in the order of about 40 cents per kilowatt that we're paying customers who are generating. And this, as I said, is closer down to the low 20s. So I can try to get back to you with an exact, a better number later, but that should give you some order of magnitude.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pascoe.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would be remiss not to make an argument that many of the folks in the work group would make, which is that, yes, there's definitely an upfront cost to these systems, and I think you've heard that, you know, this expansion is pretty modest and the upfront cost is relatively low. I think some folks will argue that while, yes, there is an upfront cost, that we're investing in solar that has a life of 15 to 20 to 25 years, a fixed cost that at some point pays off and then starts to produce free energy for the system. And there are people that will argue that over that period of time there would actually be a net negative cost to ratepayers. So I think that that's part of the we're doing a study in part to get answers to some of these questions so that we can decide how to move forward.
Thank you. Representative Reardon?
No. Oh, sorry, I saw my hand. Representative Wyden.
Thank you. One of you might be able to tell me, but let's just take the 25 megawatts here. How many acres of solar panels is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I think the better question is how many rooftops is it? I mean, it's not a single project. It's distributed, and that's kind of the key here. And so that's the serious question. If you're asking a little bit more tongue in cheek, it's many acres. And actually, Representative Benz, through his work on the solar siting bill, can probably give you a better, more exact answer of how many solar panels per acre you can use. But the intent is really to see how you can distribute this type of resource on a cost-effective basis. And the pilot for the feed-in tariff was really the first time, again, we sort of took the approach of paying for production of those electrons on a distributed basis. And pretty expensive on a per kilowatt hour basis, not so expensive on a per ratepayer basis. And so again, learning a lot from the current pilot, we'll learn a little bit more from the extension, and again, the study will give us even more information. That, and our hope is to come back in 2015 with both an approach of, and right now beyond the 25 megawatts, it'd be really, really expensive to do this system wide. I mean, you just really couldn't do that. And so what we're trying to do is be able to come to the legislature with a cost-effective way of paying for solar, and then a real recognition of, is there an above-market cost, and how do you buy that down over time?
Thank you. Representative Dembro.
To you.
I mean, they kind of got to it. I know, actually, the answer to quite a few of my questions. So.
Okay, well, maybe you can answer mine. No, actually, just following up on your question, although we didn't get the specific acreage, it would be a lot of acres to do that. And I know that we're having some challenges with the environmental impacts of those many acres. That's an advantage, it seems to me, of this kind of program, if we can put them up on people's roofs. The environmental impact is you know, is negligible. And so that's another benefit, I think, of this kind of program.
Well, one of the, if I may, just kind of a comment, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of curious, because if we just do a rooftop, how much would actually feed back into the system? Because to power a house, you would need almost an acre of panels. And if we're just doing the rooftop, how much power would they actually be selling back into the system? Because I would think they would use probably 100% of the power that it's generating, the solar.
I think that that's probably one of the issues that the program is going to study. And my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that there are time of day, you know, when the sun shines, when the power is used kind of issues as well.
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, that's correct. I mean, it depends on the time of day. Most residential net metering and feed-in tariff systems are sized to match or not exceed your on-site usage. I think many systems don't even fully cover 100% of on-site usage. So in many ways, from a utility perspective, rooftop solar really looks more like energy efficiency than generation. That's different when you get to some of the utility scale solar that has been discussed in other contexts. But, you know, it depends, and it does depend on the time of day, things of that nature. And I think that's part of what we want to try to look at and get a really good understanding of in this study, because from our perspective, even customers who have solar panels on their roof are still getting value from the utility system when the sun isn't shining, when we're essentially serving as their battery backup and providing power when they need it. So all of those types of issues are ones that we think we need more information on to really understand very, very well so that we can come back and craft a program that will be sustainable in the long term, that works for solar and customers that want to put solar on their roof, and also works for utility customers that cannot or do not, for whatever reason, want to have solar on their roofs.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a great idea, the study, and I'm particularly interested in the design of the study. So this is just a very general statement of areas of interest. Are we going to see something more refined when it comes to the design of the study, or is, because I've learned through unfortunate experience that if the study isn't designed pretty cleverly, the answers sometimes aren't anything close to what you were thinking. So I know what I'm thinking, but I have no idea what you guys are thinking. So what is that next little step? Maybe, Mr. Chair, you already have some direction there.
I'd be happy to hear from the panel on this. I will simply plug. I think the questions you raise are valid. I think there's also a tension with getting too prescriptive in the study for the Public Utility Commission. I would say that this committee heard back from the Public Utility Commission on a study that we asked it to do in House Bill 2960 on efficiency power purchase agreements, if you'll recall back to our informational hearing that we had at the very beginning here, that I think was also a fairly general study. They did a remarkable job with this study, partly because I think they understand some of the rabbit holes to tunnel down a little bit better than we might prescribe. So I'm comfortable with this level of specificity in statutory language, but I'd be interested to hear from the panel.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, I actually share those concerns, mainly because our interest is in getting the information we need so that all the stakeholders can come together and craft a longer-term sensible solution to all of this. And I think there's a balance to be struck between giving the PUC a little bit of leeway. My hope is that the PUC, and I think that they will, engage a number of stakeholders in helping to figure out the scope of that project and helping to particularly when we get to the point of shaping recommendations that will come out of the report, of engaging a number of the folks that were involved in the work group to be part of shaping out some of the direction that this report will go.
follow up? Please. The reason I'm asking the question is I see it, the section 4 reads, shall study the effectiveness of programs that provide incentives for the use of solar systems. Well, that almost suggests an answer that we're going to figure out how to more effectively make sure we have them. But in point of fact, if we go down further, it says, line 19, investigate the cost and benefits. And so they're quite different things. I'm very interested in the cost and benefits. As was mentioned earlier, I want to know if putting something on everybody's roof, in fact, makes any sense at all. I think last time we talked about it, I was reminded of a survivalist sort of a thing. And, you know, maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong. A lot of money being spent on those roofs that could be avoided otherwise. But maybe not. I just don't want the outcome to be preordained by virtue of the language I see here.
Right. If I may, Mr. Chair, I think that was part of the conversation of even looking at what some other states are doing, looking at existing programs and potential new programs, and being able to compare the cost and benefits of all of those things so that we could all kind of collectively look at it and say what is the best system to move forward with in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, very quickly, Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, I will say, too, that the Public Utility Commission, I think, excels at sort of public process, and before we even get into the details, there's going to be sort of some scoping exercises and that sort of thing, so, you know, we can sort of put, you know, everybody puts ideas on the table, and we can really sort of prioritize and order them and how they group together and that sort of thing, and that's, you know, frankly, that's sort of what we do over there. And so, you know, I know from our perspective, we have a level of confidence that, you know, we're going to really be able to get down to the details, be able to everybody understanding what we're studying, and then, as Chair Bailey said, kind of get down into the rabbit holes that we need to and figure out, you know, what's going on and be able to report back to you. And we can certainly keep you updated on that process.
Okay. One more.
One more. When you're getting ready to do this study, not only the solar panels, but I'd like to find out just a little information on what it costs on leaving gas turbines set idle when they have to ramp them up and down, because there's a lot of wear and tear that happens to the equipment over those processes that leads to increased maintenance cost and things like that. So a lot of that stuff I'd like to see factored into this as well, as part of the cost, because you have a lot of turbines that are out there just running idle, and they're most likely to fail on startup or after a rebuild. So if you could look at that as well.
That's a good point. Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to second or build on Representative Benz's comments, and I would hope that sincerely hope that the work group wouldn't begin with some preconceived notions or those type of, what do we call them, sacred cows, if you will, that we feel like we have to hold on to. That even if a good faith examination of the topic, even if it might lead us to the conclusion that we've set off down some paths as a state that maybe aren't the best long-term paths, that they would have the courage to point that out and say, you know what, if we went this way, it would be more efficient for everyone. Particularly regard, obviously, regard to where we site solar and how we do that and the type of incentives that it's necessary to make that happen. I really hope that we can have a good faith effort with bringing a clean slate to the discussion, if you will, and everything's on the table. And at the end of the process, I think you're going to have much more buy-in to whatever those conclusions are. So I appreciate your work.
Representative Whitsitt.
This is just a question I don't know the answer to. Are there other solar-derived energy systems besides solar photovoltaic? For some reason, I have in my mind there is something else besides that that utilizes solar to produce energy. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's what's called concentrated solar, where you basically put a bunch of mirrors and focus in on that. That's really a utility scale sort of effort. We're really looking at a, you know, smaller scale, you know, residential, small business type of approach where, you know, in terms of energy generation, photovoltaic is basically what's available. You just can't do the concentrated solar on a small scale that makes any sense.
Could I follow up? How do the two compare on a large scale? The photovoltaic cells versus the concentrated mirrors?
We could probably take that offline.
Yeah, we can find that. I would suspect that because you're seeing a lot more photovoltaic arrays and systems being set up and not that many concentrated solars, that concentrated solar is probably a little bit more expensive, but we'll find out the right answer and go for that.
Chair Bailey, Representative Woodson, I'm certainly not the expert on this, but I think they also have different applications that they're better suited for. We can find out more about the cost for you, but you know, one is really more suited for energy generation, while another really is better suited for heating. So,
okay. Thank you very much to this panel. We appreciate your work on this. Lisa Nato, please, and Joe Esmond.
They're coming up. Representative Whitsitt, I personally print my solar panels.
Nato.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Nato of Julian Nato, a government relations and lobbying firm. But I'm speaking to you today as a private citizen and also as a former member of this committee. I was vice chair of the House Energy and Environment Committee a long time ago, so I don't want to go there. But I do consider it the best committee of the legislature, and I appreciate your work and service on this committee. I support the Dash 2 amendments and urge your adoption. I worked with Mark Pengilly originally on the original solar pilot program in 2009 that was adopted, and that has been a very successful program. It pays incentives, as you've learned, to small consumer generators, and that is mostly rooftop solar. It uses no general fund, no tax credits, and it provided, as you've heard, 25 megawatts over 5 years. It's been very successful and very popular. There's a great demand for it. The first allocation, I believe, was sold out in allocated in about 11 minutes. It's created a large number of jobs in Oregon. These jobs are jobs that have, for people who have developed expertise in installation, in design and engineering, how to utilize the rooftop effectively to maximize the solar. The competition in these jobs has in turn brought down the cost of solar installation in our state, and now many people are using panels that are actually made in our state. The incentive rates for solar have decreased over 40% in the last 3 years. I've met with many of you, and I appreciate the time you gave me and Mark Pengilly, who is here today, to talk about amendments to House Bill 2812 to amend the solar pilot program and have a modest expansion. House Bill 2893, as originally filed, would have repealed this solar pilot program. We appreciate Representative Reardon. He invited us to participate in the work group, and thank you, Adam, as well. We agree that the process was very collaborative and informative for all the parties involved. The Dash 2 amendments represent a compromise that was reached this week in the work group. So instead of a repeal, the Dash 2 amendments would add this 2.5 megawatts to the solar pilot, extends it for one more year, and I think everyone at the work group is committed to looking for solutions that work and are cost-effective. This program, the 2.5 extension, is targeted to the commercial and business owners. The effect of the rate is very minimal. Oregonians for Renewable Energy Policy estimates that it's less than 1 cent a month. So we appreciate your work, your support of this, and I know Mark Pengilly is here, and he could answer some of the questions you may have brought up today, but we support the amendments, and we appreciate the work group and the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nato. Mr. Esmond.
Good afternoon. My name is Joe Esmond, IBW 48 business agent. First of all, I want to answer, if I may, through the chair, Mr. Widener's question.
Please.
A megawatt laid end to end, butt to butt, it's a football field. Okay. Yeah, that's. So that'll give you an idea of a visual. Second of all, I would really like, and I know you have the interstate laws about commerce and everything else, but having been involved in helping a little bit
to stop the import, the flooding of solar panels into America. I would really like to find a way to use the Oregon products to do these things. And I'm sure there's lawyers that abound. But we have 15 industries that are affiliated with the solar industry in the state, and I'm sure they would like to get a piece of this work. Third, when they do the investigation through the PUC, I think you should be looking at some of the quality and a thorough review of some of the installations. Some may not be kosher. Some may be putting solar on a house like mine where you have sun, you don't have sun past 1 o'clock. I mean, this, so that should be investigated. Over the years, through various agencies, some public, some NGOs, etc. I don't think it's good policy because we just discussed the energy efficiency for people who have money, you know, don't have money. Why would somebody put solar on a house that was like mine, 1925, insulation in the walls, about this thick? Why should that be done, either with ratepayer money or taxpayer's money? I know I'm going to, and here again, I'll go to the next committee and argue for solar someplace else, but we've trained 2,000 people in this business. So I know it's unpopular, some of the things I say, but I really would like to have American-made products, Oregon-made products on these installations, and a review of the quality of the feed-in tariff that's been done. I've been unpopular before, so...
Thank you.
I think we can agree.
And we're buddies.
No, we can. I think we both agree. We want Oregon jobs. We want the Oregon solar industry to expand here in Oregon.
Yes.
So thank you.
I don't think there's disagreement.
Questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 3rd, 2013, to House Bill 2893.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 3rd, 2013. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, is there any objection on the amendment? Okay. Amendment is adopted. We'll carry over the work session on House Bill 2893 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2005. Call up Stan Danielson and Al Davis, please.
Chairman, I have handouts. Do I give them to
Please her? Give them to Ann, and she'll distribute them.
We're carrying it over.
I already carried it over, yeah. Please.
Okay, good afternoon, Chairman Bailey, Vice Chairs Boone and Johnson, and members of the Oregon House Committee on Energy and Environment. Thank you for holding this public hearing on House Bill 2005. My name is Stan Danielson. I'm the business manager for the Heat and Frost Insulators, Local 36. We cover the jurisdiction of Oregon and five counties of Southwest Washington. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and share with the committee the contributions that our union and our union contractors are making to advance energy efficiency in the state of Oregon. This creates and maintains good jobs in Oregon and reduces carbon emissions. Mechanical insulation is a proven technology that reduces energy costs for commercial and industrial facilities for both new construction and retrofit maintenance. Mechanical insulation also creates immediate jobs for our insulation suppliers, contractors, our skilled men and women who install mechanical insulation. Additional benefits include a significant return on investment and the reduction of life cycle cost. This improves sustainable efficiency, worker safety from contact with hot and cold surfaces, reduces condensation and mold prevention, and improves air quality. Buildings are responsible for 40% of U.S. energy demands and 40% of all greenhouse gas emissions, making efficiency gains in this area critical if we are to reduce Americans' energy consumption and reduce carbon emissions. The industrial sector will also benefit in energy-efficient opportunities. At the residential level, insulation is a well-known benefit. However, the same cannot be said for commercial and industrial sectors, which together consume 2.5 times more energy than homes. Commercial and industrial insulation, collectively known as mechanical insulation, can slash the energy demand for buildings, and in the industrial sector. I want to thank House Speaker Kotek for introducing House Bill 2005. We very much appreciate her leadership to create green energy jobs in Oregon and make our state industrial sector more energy efficient and cost competitive. Our state has a long record of energy and environmental stewardship, which also applies to our state energy codes. I'm very happy and pleased that Oregon is ahead of many states with the implementation of updated energy codes for new construction. However, we believe that there are many opportunities for additional energy efficiencies with mechanical insulation. I'd like to share with the committee some ideas where we can and should make improvements. The codes for mechanical insulation is only the first step. Many states and municipal energy officials think that because they have the code in place, their work is done. But we need to make sure that they are effectively enforced to ensure that new construction includes the recommended levels of insulation. Unfortunately, we know from experience that the code standards for insulation are not always followed because many contractors utilize value engineering to reduce the initial building construction cost. Often mechanical insulation is reduced as a result of value engineering. This means the thicknesses of the materials are reduced. Reduced or insulation is eliminated as a non-essential system. The building will function with or without recommended levels of mechanical insulation, but the initial savings to cut mechanical insulation will be offset by increased energy costs to heat and cool the building. Another area for energy efficiency improvements is maintenance work. The U.S. Department of Energy estimates that between 10 and 30% of mechanical insulation that should be in place is missing or damaged to a point that it is useless. The average hospital has about 13 miles of insulated pipe and 4 acres of insulated duct. Then when we have as much as 1 mile of damaged piping and 1/2 acre of insulated duct that needs repair or replacing. The industrial sector is not much better at maintenance than the commercial sector. The question is, why don't they maintain the insulation? Again, just as new construction, the building will function with or without insulation, but there are added costs and added carbon emissions. Based on data from more than 700 industrial energy assessments, it is estimated that the implementation of a comprehensive mechanical insulation maintenance and upgrade program nationally would generate $4.8 billion in energy savings, reduce 43 million metric tons of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions, and create and sustain 89,000 jobs annually. Best of all, these jobs do not require additional research and development. Mechanical insulation opportunities can be easily identified with potential energy savings and emission reductions determined with proven Department of Energy utilization of software technologies. For facility owners and operators, the savings are swift and sustainable. The return on the investment from mechanical insulation typically is less than 2 years and sometimes as little as 6 months. the most cost-effective, cleanest energy source in Oregon and throughout the country is energy that is conserved. On behalf of the members of Insulators Union Local 36 and our union contractors, we're very proud of 100-year tradition of work and contributions to energy efficiency, and we're very pleased to extend an invitation to you to visit our apprenticeship training facilities, where we can show you how we train our next generation of skilled craft professionals. Thank you again for holding this important hearing to increase the awareness of value and the value of mechanical insulation. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Please.
Chair Bailey, distinguished members of the committee, my name is Al Davis. I'm the business agent for Local 36 Heat and Frost Insulators. I am an Oregon native, an Oregon veteran. I have 30 years experience in the construction industry, running insulation crews out on projects as big as Intel and as small as private homes. So I have a pretty varied work history. Stan pretty much covered most of the facts here. As far as like the value engineering and stuff that happens to us out on the projects, I just want to go over again the savings that they get from that is just a small amount, and in the long term leads to energy loss, mold growth, corrosion of mechanical systems, and increased carbon emissions. We all lose in that case. He talked about the typical return of investment is sometimes right around 6 months. That's great for any product. That's outstanding. So win-win for everyone and doesn't cost anything extra. In fact, that's a savings for the taxpayers. It takes about 8,000 hours of training to produce a professional insulator. So it's a trade we take very serious. And we look forward to working with people like Mr. Mark Long's here, who I just met today. And we'd like to help educate the inspectors and building owners and the general public on the values of mechanical insulation. It's been an honor to speak to you today, so thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative.
I think the last high-temperature pipe I touched was on a ship, and it was wrapped in asbestos. Is there still a lot of asbestos-wrapped pipe out there? And anyway, for me.
Yes. You know, in 1973, they outlawed asbestos as far as being installed, but we're still removing it. Every once in a while, there'll be a ship that comes in. We did a huge asbestos abatement job on a ship here in Portland. It went to China, came back, and when they did the repairs over there, they installed asbestos. So we do still run into asbestos a lot in the shipyards. We were told just recently that only 20% of the asbestos in our country has been removed that was installed over the last 100 years.
Well, is there something that, you know, if there's asbestos in a building, it's a major ordeal and a very expensive process to have to remove that. And what I'm thinking, if I'm a business owner, would I maybe hesitate to report damaged asbestos pipes? Would that be one of the reasons that people aren't replacing it? And
I think what it is what I'd mentioned, is that you have this immediate cost up front, so they prolong it, they don't get it done, really realizing that they're losing energy and it's costing them money in the long run. I think a lot of like if you look at the piping systems and so forth, we've done a lot of the removal in the paper mills, the schools. I'm surprised that every year, even in the Salem school districts, we're still doing removal. You would think it would be done. We started the asbestos removal process in about 1984, 1985, and we're still doing it. So there's must still be a lot of it out there. But I don't know whether it's so much to answer your question that it's asbestos, they don't want to mess with it, and then therefore they don't want to spend that money to do the removal and the re-insulation.
Okay. I just thought there might be an opportunity there.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Do you know if when they measure the carbon emissions resulting from the insulation efficiency, if they take into consideration the carbon emissions created by the creation of the insulation materials themselves?
I'm sure that there's a study that's done on that, but I would think it would be very, very minute in comparison to the cost of manufacturing insulation.
What could you give us types of insulation that you're talking about? I'm looking at the pictures, and it looks like a whole variety of. Could you give some examples of what your insulation materials would be made of?
Sure. Like today, the majority of it would be like on a hot and cold system, chilled water systems and so forth would be fiberglass. We use different types of urethanes and so forth as you get into chilled water systems, refrigeration systems and so forth. When you get in, there's another type, they call it Rubitex. Some people may have seen it. It's just that black spongy kind of rubber insulation. They use a lot of that on chilled water systems, mostly for cold, not so much for heat. And then like on your ducts and so forth, they have a blanket type insulation that they use on that. But we have different types of insulation depending on the temperature ranges. So we insulate things that are sometimes 450 degrees, mm-hmm. and we have other things we insulate that are 300 degrees below zero. So there's different types of insulation that we do. And I think what we're looking for here is to just educate. That's our primary goal, is to work with building codes departments and so forth to educate them of the fact that, you know, the value of this mechanical insulation. And one of the things our international has done, and they spoke to me last week and said they were willing to do a study. If we could pick, you know, three or four buildings in the Salem, Portland area or whatever and do an energy audit for free of charge, so you'd have a better sense of, you know, what they're looking at. They did one, a huge one in the state of Montana, and came back with a lot of information. You know, they're looking at things that maybe a valve that's not insulated, so they could say, well, this valve runs at 250 degrees, X amount of energy loss there, how much does that cost you over time, how much does it cost to insulate it, how long does it take to get a return on your dollar? So a lot of those studies have been done, and I would look forward to doing that in some buildings in the Portland or in the, you know, Salem or in Oregon, whether I actually did this building here myself. So it was done properly. But I think one of the things that we run into more than anything is when we talked about the value engineering part of it, we have codes. There's only so many people to get out there and do the inspections. But unfortunately, I'll go to a job, whether it be in Redmond or Bend, a brand new high school, and I'm looking at the job site specifications, and it calls for 2.5-inch wall insulation on a steam pipe. And then if it's below 2 inches, it's 2-inch wall. And I'll walk on a job where everything is done in 1-inch wall. Well, they paid for 2.5-inch wall, which costs more money, but in the long term is going to save more money. But they either value engineer it, or there's people out there that cut corners and don't install per the job site, you know, specifications. So for a lot of inspectors, they've got a lot to inspect when they go on the job, and they look up and they go, geez, the pipes are insulated. They're all white. Looks good to me. They don't realize that somebody put 1/2-inch wall material on a job instead of 2.5-inch wall that it called for. So I brought up pictures to the school district over there, and I showed them. I said, here's your specifications. Is there anywhere in the specifications that calls for a 1/2-inch wall material? And he goes, absolutely not. I go, here's the pictures of all the material boxes sitting on your job. It's all 1/2-inch wall material. So those are the kind of things that, with the help from building codes and whatever, to educate school districts and utilities and so forth, that one is to make sure they're getting what they paid for and the reason that it's important to install the product properly and to give them what they paid for.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to ask a question, but I just want to get your take on this, because I've been a supervisor of an insulator, and I must say he was probably one of my best employees because I never had to talk to him. He just mm-hmm. went and did his job. But one of the biggest problems that we saw in pulp mill is it was more when you tear into equipment. And I'm thinking with buildings, it's not so much at the installation point, it's going in and doing maintenance afterwards, that it's not restored properly. And I don't see how a building where they could afford to have an insulator around to actually do things properly. And do you think that's the bigger issue than getting the wrong size or wrong material? And in a bid?
Right. There's two parts of it. One of it has to do, I'm sorry, I should go do the...
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
It's the after installation is where I see the big problem. You pull out a pump, you know, because they don't have somebody on site that can do this, because it's a skilled craft.
Correct.
I mean, you guys heard 8,000 hours. These guys are good at what they do. So for me to go hire someone to come in and do that, it costs a lot of money. So I just replace the pump and I wrap it up the best of my ability.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might have been insulated so well I couldn't get to it, so I had to cut a hole into it to where I could check something.
Well, in some cases, what I talked about, there are several types of insulation. One of them would be like on a valve or a pump or something, we make what we call insulation pads or blankets or whatever that are removable. And those are the kind of things that instead of putting something that's really difficult to remove, that a maintenance person can come in and remove the pads, put in new gaskets, do whatever needs to be done, repair the valve or the pump, and then reinstall the pads. So that's part of it. But then part of it too is if you've been in that industrial setting, you see that you walk around a paper mill or a hospital or a school, and over time, you know, it's been walked off, knocked off, whatever might have been done, or maybe water dripping on it for something else, and it loses its insulation value. So that's one piece of it too, is just to, you know, inform whether new construction, maintenance work, that, you know, in the long term, they save money by having it done properly. And we see a lot of those jobs where it's just, a janitor that pulls off something, throws something back on. We're not going to be able to do all of that. But I think if they do a survey and go into some of these, you go through the tunnels, you couldn't imagine how many miles of tunnels there is under these buildings here with steam lines and so forth. And they do a pretty good job here because we have people down here quite often that are going through these tunnels and redoing the insulation, or maybe it's part of it's been torn off because it was asbestos. And then they re-insulate it with standards that codes that meet the codes of today. So,
thank you. All right. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Justin Rainey, please.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Justin Rainey. I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Food Processors Association. The association represents about 80 food processors in nearly 200 production facilities throughout the Northwest. The food processing industry is the third largest manufacturing employment sector in Oregon. The industry currently is working on goals to reduce energy intensity and become more efficient by 25% over the next 10 years and by 50% over the next 20 years. That being said, we have some concerns with House Bill 2005. Mechanical insulation would apply to boilers, chillers, and other equipment. This begins the regulation of industrial efficiencies through the building codes that are currently voluntary standards in place to address those issues. The industry believes that this should be a voluntary approach and not a mandate. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Rainey. Questions for Mr. Rainey?
Oh, last one.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Justin, are you saying that, let's see, what's the wording that throws chillers and all that other stuff in there so to where we're not simply talking about pipes and ducts and all of that? Is that in the ORS or is it in just in the mechanical insulation standards? Or
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm not an expert on it, so I don't want to give you incorrect information. We can follow up and get that to you, but my understanding is it's in the definition of mechanical insulation standards.
Okay.
That'd be helpful to know.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Justin.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. All right, anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2005? We got somebody else, okay?
Mm-hmm. briefly. Chairman Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Huntington, Deputy Administrator for Oregon Building Codes Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As you already heard, the Oregon currently has on the books, at least from a code perspective, about the one of the best standards you can with respect to this issue. Happy to work with Mr. Danielson, Mr. Davis, on some of the, trying to address some of the issues that they've raised. From a system perspective, Oregon's construction regulatory system is actually designed and relatively unique to try and address and gives us a number of tools to be able to try and address this issue. We like to think of the construction regulatory system in Oregon as a three-legged stool. The first is the standard, which we've already talked about, and we adopt those standards with 7 advisory boards, representative of the various groups and stakeholders that we work with. And so that goes through that process and has worked very well in terms of getting to standards that, as you've heard, are some of the best in the nation, including from an energy efficiency perspective. The second leg of that stool is the plan that is developed, that is the plan for how they're going to go about designing this and making sure that the structure that's about to be built is going to meet those energy efficiency standards and all of the standards that exist. And then finally, you've got the inspection, which is that last component where they're going in and ensuring that what was on the plans actually got implemented. And it sounds like that may be the area here where there's some opportunity for us to work. One of the things that makes Oregon's system unique is the level of integration at each stage of that process. At the Building Codes Division, we actually certify the inspectors and the plan reviewers who are doing that work. They have continuing education requirements that they're required to complete and to stay current on what those code requirements are. So, and to that degree, we also work with 130 jurisdictions throughout the state to make sure that the standards that we've adopted are implemented in a consistent fashion. So from that perspective, we can work with the proponents on that. Our suggestion is always, as these issues come up, work directly with the local jurisdiction, make sure that at that point, the issue is identified and we know that there's a breakdown somewhere in the system so that it can be identified at the local level and taken care of there at that point. And then finally, to the degree that we can work with the proponents on some better training to make sure that our inspectors are doing the job well and catching these issues, we're happy to do that with them. So happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions for this witness?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You hit on the points that I was picking up from the testimony, and just building a new house and going through to get the Energy Star certification, it's a third-party auditor that you have come in for that. And I wonder if that would be something maybe on the industrial side where they just had a third-party auditor who did the audit to make sure everything was done the way it should be. That might cover what we're trying to do here, or the problem that was presented to us here.
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, another possible solution. Again, I'm speaking in the perspective of our system and our role in it, which is, you know, the role that our inspectors play in going out and trying to make sure that we've built it to the code. There are obviously other possible solutions, potentially like the one that you suggest. I think one of the areas that comes up is the assumption that people make that every single item within the code is being looked at on every single structure out there, and you know, we've got a code that looks like that, and you know, a number of things that maybe in every instance you know, aren't identified. But I think with some training, some additional training of the inspectors that we do regulate, is a potential opportunity for us to try and address that.
That makes sense. Representative Vega Peterson.
I just have a comment. I just wanted to thank you for being so crystal clear on how you described the process and the of everything, because I have zero background on this, but you were talking about the three-legged stool and the 7 advisory boards, and that was really succinct and clear for me. So thanks for that.
Yeah. Chair Bailey, Representative Vega Peterson, I'm going to have to give that credit to Mark Long. That's his analogy.
He's played here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, Vice Chair Jansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know a great deal about mechanical insulation codes or industrial. I know on the residential side that there are requirements for and regarding energy efficiencies that, you know, a dwelling needs to have a kind of a total score. The total building envelope is what's in play, meaning if you wanted to invest more in glazing on your windows, you could put less over here because the total sum total of the benefits all add up. Is that in play on the industrial commercial side too, to address the concerns we heard earlier about less insulation on some ducting, but perhaps there may have been increased investments in other parts of that building envelope in that commercial environment? Is that
Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, at this point, I'm going to actually throw out a lifeline. I'm going to have my technical expert step up. Mark Heiser is our energy efficiency and mechanical code expert. He's a mechanical engineer, works at the Building Codes Division, and I'm going to allow him to respond to that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mark Heiser with Building Codes Division, technical analyst there. Chairman Bailey and Representative Johnson, to answer the question about the trade-offs possibly for insulation, for the piping systems and so forth that were in ductwork that's mentioned, there isn't a trade-off available. There's for certain pipe types, temperatures and so forth, there's a certain thickness that would be laid out within code for an industrial system or, for a commercial building for the heating. And we regulate the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning system. So to address the industrial concerns at this point through Building Codes Division, we do not regulate really the process loads. In other words, cooking lines, dryers, kilns, things like that. Mm. So our building code really covers the systems for the heating and air conditioning of the people inside the building.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Woodson.
So do you consider Oregon's code sufficient then at this time for insulation?
Representative Bailey, yes, Representative Woodson. Actually, yes, we are one of the leaders, have been for some time. We have a very thorough vetting process. I personally participate on some national code cycles, and we are currently in our adoption process for the 2014 Oregon Code. Mm-hmm. And as part of this, we're seeing not only what is happening here locally, but we also see what is being put forward both through national standards such as ASHRAE and what is going into the 2015 National Model Code. So we're seeing what happens at those locations to make sure that we're staying current with that. So our insulation levels are quite good.
Rep. Bailey and Woodson, I'd also just follow up there, and I think you heard earlier that Speaker Kotek had indicated we actually realize now that the code standard that we have is probably one about the best on the books. I think you also though heard from the proponents that there are some issues that may be existing, the breakdown in the system, making sure that it's actually taking place, and that's where there's probably some opportunity for us to cooperate and make sure that the standard that we've adopted, that's very solid and one of the best, is actually getting implemented on the plans and then is actually being incorporated on the site and making sure that that's all occurring.
Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony. Closed public hearing on House Bill 2005. Committee is adjourned.